The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Alongside Aubrey Sampson, my name is Brian Fromm. And Aubrey, you and I talk a lot on this show about abortion, right, about our thoughts, about right, the church, right, about the debates going on in culture and the Supreme Court, all of it. But one thing you and I have not talked about that is a really important aspect of this conversation that I don't feel very qualified to talk about is this idea of chemical abortion drugs and whatever else is going on out there. And so with that in mind, to have that help us out with that conversation, we are thrilled to be joined by a policy analyst for the Center for Human Dignity at the Family Research Council. Her name is Joy Stockbauer. Joy, thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you guys.
Yeah, so let's just talk about the issue that I kind of set out there at a large scale. Help us understand even the debate going on right now or the, just what's going on with chemical abortion drugs.
Yeah, so chemical abortion drugs, even before Roe v. Wade was overturned, were already accounting for over 50% of the abortions happening in the United States. So we know that chemical abortion drugs are already the future of the abortion industry, and it's the future of the narratives that the abortion industry will be selling to the American public.
Wow.
So we've already known that these are a great cause for concern. But now, you know, there's been some recent moves with the FDA changing a rule to now allow retail pharmacies to actually sell these chemical abortion drugs. And several of these large national corporations have already applied to do so. So this is bringing chemical abortion just to your neighborhood pharmacy. So it really is an epidemic.
And Joy, do you know why, like, what is prompting this change?
So chemical abortion drugs are far cheaper for the abortion industry to manufacture and to distribute. And it's also more convenient for women seeking abortions. And so, you know, they want women to believe that they can minimize the trauma and the pain of an abortion by simply taking drugs, the same as they would with any other prescription, and being able to do so at home. But what we know from survivors, from women who have had these abortions, is that these abortions are still traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
They still cause, you know, physical repercussions and, of course, psychological and emotional repercussions as well, because women are turning their own homes into abortion facilities, their own bathrooms into abortion facilities.
Oh, man. Joy, help me paint the picture even a little bit more in my mind. Are we talking like going into Walgreens, going into CVS, going into whatever, and it's just being over the counter as if I was picking up Advil? Or is it going to require a doctor's note? What's it actually going to be like in a pharmacy to get one of these?
So right now they still require a prescription, which is, you know, of course, better than if it were over the counter. But yeah, you know, picking up your prescription at a Walgreens or a CVS or a Rite Aid instead of having to go to a Planned Parenthood or an abortion facility. So of course, this is going to be more inside of women's comfort zones. This is going to make them feel like an abortion is no big deal, when in reality, an abortion is a life-altering and immensely traumatizing event. And so, you know, we already know that Planned Parenthood and abortion industries try to minimize women's reactions to their abortions. They try to tell them that any sadness that they feel is just hormones and that they'll get over it. And so this is only further playing into that narrative by making women feel like, well, what I did was so normal. I just picked it up at Walgreens. So whatever I'm feeling now, you know, it must be okay. I must be fine. Maybe I shouldn't think about this and process this and, you know, really dig deep.
Joy, I would love to hear a little bit more about the Center for Human Dignity and how you and others at the Family Research Council are recommending people respond, especially pro-life people respond to this change.
Yeah, so the Center for Human Dignity deals with, we deal with the life issue, we deal with issues related to human dignity, including human trafficking and sexual exploitation. So we also are analyzing, the relation between chemical abortion drugs and sexual exploitation, which is a really interesting conversation to have as well. We're looking at it from a couple different angles. We've sent letters to these retail pharmacies, to CVS, to Walgreens, and to Rite Aid, urging them to reverse their decision and not to go through with becoming part of the abortion industry. And we've also sent a letter to Walmart, encouraging them to keep themselves out of the abortion industry and not to seek certification. And so we've had 13 other pro-life organizations sign on to these letters, and we're really hopeful that that will make an impact on their decision, because they'll see that this is going to impact their profit margin.
And Joy, these pills in and of themselves, are they dangerous to the moms as well? Is there any side effects and physical danger here?
Absolutely. The abortion industry does not want women to know that there could be any side effects, when in reality, chemical abortions are four times as dangerous as just typical surgical abortions. And that's just considering the physical complications, the side effects like cramping and bleeding and hemorrhage, which of course is, if a woman is experiencing this abortion at home by herself, at what point is she able to recognize what amount of bleeding is normal? At what point is she able to recognize if she's hemorrhaging or if she needs to seek emergency medical care? It's putting an immense amount of responsibility in the hands of women and turning them into their own abortionists.
Joy, can you tell us, step back a little bit and just tell us a little bit about the Center for Human Dignity and how our listeners can find out more?
Absolutely. Your listeners can find us at frc.org/life. And we have a lot of resources ranging from policy briefs that share a biblical worldview on different issues related to human dignity and abortion. And we also have some pamphlets that are step-by-step guides on how readers can engage in the pro-life space and how they can have difficult conversations related to abortion. We recently launched a resource that is a man's guide to standing for life on, educating men on how to have some of these conversations that they don't feel like they're allowed to have. Our center really just, we engage on the policy side, but we also just try to equip the pro-life movement to engage intelligently and compassionately on the life issue.
And Joy, one last question. What would you encourage pastors and churches to be doing right now? Is it to just raise awareness? Is it protesting and boycotts? What would you guys at the Family Research Council be encouraging of churches?
Yeah, I would encourage churches just to have open dialogue and conversation at church about, the evils of abortion and what a biblical worldview of life is, because the Bible does speak so much to God's love for life and for respecting life in the womb, because it was created fearfully and wonderfully. So I think having that baseline conversation is a great way to propel a congregation into saying, how can we now take action? How can we serve mothers in our communities? How can we change the culture of our church if it's a culture where women might feel like they can't be open about an unexpected pregnancy or pregnancy outside of marriage? How do they change that to become a life-affirming church where women know that they're safe and women know that they're going to be helped if they're in a difficult situation?
Joy Stockbauer, again, is a policy analyst for the Center for Human Dignity at Family Research Council. Joy, this was super helpful. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for being with us, Joy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yep, you're listening to The Common Good, AM 1160, hope for your life. We are thrilled to be joined by the host of Focus on the Family's The Boundless Show and also the author of The Dating Manifesto. Her name is Lisa Anderson. Lisa, how you doing? Thanks for joining us today.
It is so great to be here. Hello, hello.
Yeah, it's so good to have you with us. And Lisa, a lot of what you do and a lot of what you talk about is dating and healthy, godly relationships. I want to bring up a word that it made me feel old, because I heard this word the other day and I said to myself, man, I'm only 45, but I've never heard this word before. And it is the word situationship. Can you explain to our audience what a situationship is?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of the case where if there's not a word to describe it, you have to make one up. So yes. Kind of what happened here. I actually feel like I've been around this word for a long time, but I actually call it the friendlationship.
Okay.
It seems like more pervasively happening in the culture is this, referring to it as the situationship. And you could see outside of a Christian context, really what a situationship is, it's just letting a pseudo-relationship happen without any definition. So it could be anything. Like, it could be whatever you want it to be. Mm. So for those who, you know, maybe don't necessarily walk from a biblical structure, it could be friends with benefits.
Okay.
Random hookups.
Okay.
It could be just being awkward friends and hanging out a lot. So that's kind of where it is. And then how you move that into a more biblical or a church or Christian context is when I call it the friendlationship. It's kind of that you start out as friends. One person usually starts having feelings for the other person, and they figure, you know what, I'm just going to hang in here because I literally have watched every 80s or 90s and I know that in 90 minutes, this guy's going to turn to me and be in love with me.
Right.
And so they just kind of bide their time. But then what happens is, because there's no definition, you're just kind of doing whatever. And a lot of times there's a lot of connection in the relationship. Mm. You know, these are the two people who know each other's Starbucks drinks. They do their last phone call of the night. They do pizza nights, movie nights, whatever. But then one day the dude, you know, like, let's say it's Brian and Ashley. And Brian's like, hey, Ashley, what do you think about Rachel? And she's like, well, who's Rachel? Well, that new girl in our small group. And she's like, well, I don't know. I don't even know who that is. And he's like, well, I'm thinking of asking her out.
Yeah.
Okay, so now Ashley either needs to punch him in the face or burst into tears.
Yes.
Or she needs to go eat 3 pints of Ben and Jerry's.
Because
he just discovered
Ashley.
He's in a situationship.
Yeah. Okay, this is so good, Lisa, because I feel like I've got some single friends that are definitely in some situationships. I'm hearing some red flags, but could you be very overt about them? What are the red flags of a situationship? What do you do if you find yourself in one?
Yeah, and sometimes it can be sneaky because you start out fully intending to, quote, just be friends. The problem is, as you build connection, and this is something that I always tell young adults, I say, whatever your relationship you are in, the level of connection that you have with the other person should never exceed the level of commitment you have to that person.
That's good advice.
This is where you have to kind of evaluate. So this is why I'm a big fan of calling a date a date. And you actually have to say the word date, because if this person doesn't say, I would love to take you out to dinner. And I mean, again, okay, maybe you need to call it a date at any juncture. It needs to be known that this is something beyond just hanging out. And so one of the biggest red flags is that you don't really know where you stand. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're assuming something, but you've not heard anything verbalized by the other person. The other red flag is when you feel like the relationship isn't really going anywhere. It's not progressing. So you've now known this person or been hanging out 6 months, 8 months, a year, and you have not actually defined what this is. It could be, you know, maybe there are things that are being done in groups as well, or maybe this guy or girl is showing the same amount of attention to someone else.
Mm.
Well, you have to realize that there has to be some established boundaries and continuum and understanding of what are we actually calling this. And if you don't have that, you probably are in something super vague and going nowhere.
Yeah, wow.
Aubrey, I've just realized, Lisa just helped me realize that 25 years ago, my future wife and I were in a situation.
I was literally thinking this, right? All the stories that you've told us, they were in a situation.
They really were. I can't wait to tell her about this
today. So sometimes it works out. So is there some positivity, Lisa, to a situationship?
I think there is. I mean, here's the deal. It's kind of like when women are frustrated because guys aren't asking them out. So they're like, okay, well, I'm just going to have to manipulate the situation and make it happen. My sister did this because she dated this guy who was this precious farmer who only said like four words a week. And, you know, she just couldn't get him to say anything or do anything. So she finally like made a date happen. Okay, so she kind of pulled the trigger, made it happen. Well, then he was able to pick up the reins and run with that. She just had to get the ball rolling.
Yeah.
If you've done that and the ball still isn't rolling, then you realize
you have to move on.
Yeah, exactly. So it can happen. And sometimes it's just fear or awkwardness or whatever. But really, I mean, anyone who's watched the movie, He's Just Not That Into You, knows that if a guy is interested at some point, he's going to indicate his
interest. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's
Lisa,
true.
I do need to just be honest that I was the one chasing. let me ask you this question, Lisa, because Aubrey and I both have kids who are older now. And so I feel like in my own life, I've gone from thinking about dating and early marriage and stuff to now worrying about my kids dating. What would you tell parents of teenagers, college kids? What are the conversations we should be having with our kids? What do we need to understand kind of about the dating landscape as we want our kids to date in a Christ-honoring and healthy way?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first thing I'm going to say is generally unpopular with most people, especially teenagers, for example. I would tell parents of teens in particular that your teenage years are not really the time to be in one-on-one exclusive relationships. Because the point is, where is this thing going to go?
Yeah.
It's going to go nowhere. It's going to go. It's going to ultimately be a colossal waste of time and or, again, getting back to that connection commitment, you're going to build intimacy with another person without really being able to go anywhere with it. And a lot of time that precipitates, you know, an inappropriate relationship physically or otherwise. And so I say your teen years are a great opportunity to practice communication skills, practice honoring the opposite gender, being in groups, hanging out, having fun, learning how to treat women like ladies, ladies, how to respect men in your sphere, understand how to do that. And certainly, you know, in groups or serving through church events or having fun, no problem there.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I would say the challenges, you know, and we would all love, and this is where when young adults get into college and beyond, we would all love it if we could just open our Bibles and turn to first and second dating and be told exactly what to do.
Right.
But unfortunately, that doesn't exist. And so we have to utilize principles. And I say, you know, help your young adult children, if they're going to start dating, understand that, first of all, dating is done with a purpose. And the end purpose is hopefully marriage for those who are called to marriage.
Right.
It's not, otherwise you're going to have 9 years of random pizza dates and, you know, nothing's really happening. So you have to have that end goal in mind. Now, you don't want to be so worked up about it that you're like building a life with this person after having, you know, done two dates.
Yeah.
You want to have fun. You want to keep it casual, but you always want to have that intention in mind. And the other thing I would really encourage parents of young adults to do is to date in community. So the last thing you need to do is be all behind your parents' back or behind mentors' backs.
Yeah.
Just gazing into this other person's eyes. You need to have other people with objective eyes on your relationship, telling you what's what, helping you look for red flags, helping you pray through the relationship and the situations you're in. And to do that and recognize that, you know, it's not just some storybook romance.
Yeah.
You're actually, you know, learning to love another person, learning to walk through life with them. And I think when you have other people who've gone before you in that, you're going to be much better set up to do it well.
Ah, that's super helpful. Lisa Anderson is the host of Focus on the Families, The Boundless Show. And I also encourage you to pick up her book, The Dating Manifesto. Lisa, thanks so much. This is delightful. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yep. You're listening to The Common Good, AM 1160. Hope for your life.
Joined by friend of the show, Bob Smetana. He's a veteran religion writer and national reporter for Religion News Service. We love having him here with us. Bob, thanks for being here today.
I'm great. How are you?
Doing really, really good. So, big event this weekend. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's called the Super Bowl.
We're just impressed that you've heard of it.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Sports fans everywhere, really, really excited. But one thing that Brian and I have been talking about and everyone's been seeing are some of these He Gets Us ads, sort of these pro-Jesus ads. You wrote something about there's a big Super Bowl feature, kind of a $20 million ad promoting this idea that Jesus gets us. Can you unpack that for us, Bob? Tell us the story.
Sure. So there's going to be two ads. One's going to be, I think, 90 seconds, not 90 minutes.
Ooh, that's
seconds. One's 30 seconds. So they're pretty big ads. So they cost about $20 million. This is part of a pretty massive campaign. It started out as $100 million. Now they say it's going to be $1 billion in advertising over the next 3 years.
Wow.
Aimed at, it's sort of aimed at what they call open, spiritually open skeptic about Christianity, but not turned off all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a second market is, I think Christians who might have forgotten the kind of promoted about loving your neighbor and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, but it's a huge deal. It's going to be, and it was a little bit hard to find out because the folks it's not sponsored by a particular church. They were trying to be pretty quiet about the funding, but some of the money is coming from the Green family that runs Hobby Lobby. Which is not surprising.
No, not at all. That's
not
fascinating.
At all. Yeah, I did not know that.
Many of us have seen these during the football playoffs, the He Gets Us, and they're interesting because you're like, I think this might be a Jesus commercial, but I'm not sure until the end. And Bob, I wonder your thoughts as you talk to people about this. Do you think this is effective? Like, do you think this is going to be effective or has been effective to this point with whatever their goal is?
So that's the $1 billion question. I think a couple things. I think there are, because we're so divided, I think some people are skeptical because they're like, who is behind this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the ads is one about Jesus being a refugee, which seems more politically liberal. Some that seem more conservative. So there's mistrust about that. You know, I think the bigger question is, so people hear these ads, they say, okay, I'm interested in Jesus. And they show up at a church. Well, do they experience Jesus there?
Mm-hmm.
Will they feel connected to that? Because people like Jesus. Everybody likes Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, people don't like Christians all the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes because they've had conflict with them. And
Bob, it is fascinating. Like a lot of us have seen those commercials during the NFL playoffs, and now this big one coming, or the big two coming at the Super Bowl. And I guess as I think about it, Bob, as I watch it, I just wonder to myself, is it effective? What does effectiveness look like? What are you hearing from people about whether they think this is effective?
Well, that's the $1 billion question, right? As you say, so I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, people are looking at him, and some people are suspicious because they think, well, maybe these ads are too liberal. There's one about Jesus being a refugee, or maybe they're too conservative. They don't know who's behind them. I think also kind of the bigger question is people like Jesus.
Right.
They don't always like Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
They've gotten sometimes from churches because we're so divided. I was telling someone this. I heard a sermon. First half of the sermon, the pastor's talking about how the left is out to get it. And sometimes you hear the right is out to get it. But in this case, it was the left out to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start talking about the evangelism campaign. I thought, well, you just told everyone who's not there you don't like them.
Yes.
Wow.
Are they going to come into a church and find Jesus? Are they going to find a welcome? Are they going to be able to come there? But I do think, you know, if you spend $1 billion on brand management for Jesus, that means the Christians behind this think they have a problem, that something has gone wrong, that you don't do this unless you think, oh, people are not connecting with Jesus. And so I think that's a kind of admission that something needs to change. But we'll see what happens.
It's interesting to me, Bob, that you called it brand management for Jesus. Do you really think that's what they're doing, or is it brand management for Christians, like you kind of just said, we're admitting we have a problem, or is it both?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I think the folks behind it would say they're trying to chide their or cajole the Christians, remind fellow Christians what it's like to be, what Jesus is like. I think this is an admission that people are disconnected from Christianity. I think that's the other problem is congregations in America are in such trouble. They're really are disintegrating. They're shrinking. Mm-hmm. So when people show up, will they be churches for them to go to?
Yeah.
And right. then so many of our churches are divided politically and socially that will be people will be able to find a place where they experience this ethic that Jesus and this love that Jesus talks about.
Yeah, we'd encourage people as you're watching the Super Bowl this weekend to check out those ads. It'll be interesting to see what they put all the money towards and hear from people whether or not they think it's effective. Bob, we often have you on to talk about deep struggles and things within the church. But you wrote something that, you know, the movie Groundhog Day, that was right in our wheelhouse of when we were younger. And you wrote on Groundhog Day, I'll just read people the title, but I would just for love for you to unpack it and explain it. You wrote, after 30 years, Buddhist-inspired message of Groundhog Day still holds spiritual power. Tell us more about that.
Okay, so Groundhog Day is the best. So I lived in, for full disclosure, I live in Woodstock, Illinois, where it was filmed.
So nice.
Yes, and so I live right down the street from where it's filmed. So it's been, so the interesting thing about Groundhog Day is it is, it's probably the most religious film that has no real organized religion or God in it, right? Nobody talks about God. So the early screenplay had Bill Murray's character. So if you don't know, Bill Murray plays this kind of self-centered weatherman, comes to town for Groundhog Day, thinks he's going to leave and go out to this big network job. He's better than everybody. Very condescending.
Yeah.
Gets stuck there day after day. And so then he has to, and he's trying, he thinks, well, this is great. There's no consequences for what I do. So first he does, he basically commits all the seven deadly sins, right? And then he's like, I'm still unhappy. And eventually he tries to win this girl he loves, and he has to decide to become a better person. So part of this is there's a kind of Buddhism to this. So Buddhism, this idea is called samsara, that people are caught in a cycle of rebirth. And sometimes people, when they hear about reincarnation in the popular culture, they go, well, that'd be great. I get a second chance. But really, the Buddhist idea is that, no, you have to relive your same life over and over.
Until you get it right.
Right.
Wow.
So it's punishment, right? And so there's that part of it. But people have thought, well, this is a Christian movie, and this is a Jewish movie. What's really interesting, I think there's something, it connects to, I think, what we talked about with that he gets us. What is that? So Bill Murray wants to be famous, and he wants to be loved, and he wants the girl, and he can't get it by striving after those things.
Yeah.
What does he have to do? He has to realize he's terrible, and then he, by practicing being better. So he ends up learning everyone in the town, pays attention to people. There's a kid who, in one scene, has got a broken leg in a hospital. Well, then he runs around all day, you know, helping people. And so he builds. So if you're thinking about it as a Buddhist, you'd say, well, he's getting good karma to break the cycle. But he's also, like, changing as he pays attention and practice. So the guy who wrote it, a guy named Danny Rubin, says the lessons he learned was like paying attention to your life and changing your attitude. And then that small things really matter. And so I think that's, so it's kind of a, you know, you look at this movie, it's kind of funny and it's goofy, but there's this kind of message that
that's right.
You could be better. And it's, and that part of the way we become better is to practice things, right? So if you go back to this, he gets us, right? What is the way that people learn that Jesus gets them through his people? It's by experiencing the love of people who follow Jesus. And so there's kind of a little bit of a connection there. I think the movie's really great because what the, you know, what Bill Murray wants is to be loved and have influence, and he doesn't get it by forcing it. He gets it by being a good neighbor and by loving his people, and that the acts of love help are part of the transformation of his life.
That's a good word, man.
And his relationship.
I just always, I love that movie, but I'm always like, all right, that's got to be the last one. That's got to be the last one.
It, right?
I know. It's like, he's like, oh no. But it's like so awesome, right?
It is.
Yeah.
It's such a good
message there that you wouldn't necessarily have thought about, and just a great movie. I love that. Well, Bob Smetana is a veteran religion writer and national reporter for Religion News Service. Bob, we love having you on. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Have a great day.
You too.
You're listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Hope for your life. We'll be back again on Monday from 4 to 6 p.m. For Brian Fromm, I'm Aubrey Sampson, and you've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.